Well, Betty, maybe what we could do now is trace from, say, that period of 56-57, when your recording secretary, then you go back to the bargaining committee, trace two things. One, your positions in the union and what's happening in the to you in the union and to other women, the extent to which other women are becoming more active, and what's happening in the shop in terms of your own positions. At what point do you go through changes in classification and in jobs there, too? So maybe we could do both those things. Then you showed me the Long Beach Aid United Way letter, which is from 1961. So you're also more and more involved in the community and representing the
union
community. Oh, yes.
Chapter Strike, we became more and more and more, because that was my first really close work with some of your social agencies in the strike. And then we became recognized as part of the Douglas Aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't go to Douglas Aircraft if we wanted things done. It was a joint thing. We established our blood bank out there too, you know. Jointly, Douglas Aircraft and the UAW.
Mm-hmm.
The joint account.
So it seems like you were involved on the one hand in the shop, on the other in the union, and then also in these community activities.
Oh, yes.
Now, maybe we can trace each of those things and the changes that occurred over the period.
I don't know if I can do it chronologically or not. I don't know. I just don't know, you know. But
well, let's first start really with the changes in your job classification.
Well, my job classification didn't change union-wise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my job classification didn't change until I went into out of the bargaining unit, where I took a job that was out of the bargaining unit as a factory specialist.
Now, when was that?
What year was that? Let me see. Golly, I don't know. 64, 5, something like that. Back in there.
Now, up until that time, you were
lead man.
Spares,
and then after spares, then we built the C-74, and after spares, then we built, we had the 133, and I was a lead man then, and I had a section of the cowling on that, and panels on that, and then we had 133, 124, and RB-66, I was a lead over all of them. I had different parts of the airplane to build.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just spares, it was just a big hunk of the airplane. You know.
Now, how much time were you in the shop, say, of a 40-hour work week? How much time were you functioning in your crew as lead? And how much time were you out on union?
Well, as a recording secretary, it averaged about 2 days a week I'd be at the hall.
And then how about when you went back to the bargaining committee again?
Well, when I was in the, I was up there, we had hearings about 2 days a week we'd have hearings, grievance hearings.
So
and the rest of the time,
committee was still handling grievances.
And then 2 days that I'd be in the plant with hearings, I'd be paid by the company, but they'd also be a temporary lead out there too, taking my place, being paid.
Now, what happened until you went into the management position out of the bargaining unit? Did that whole structure, were you still on the bargaining committee?
No, I went back to the recording secretary again.
Oh, you went back again?
The recording secretary again.
Now, what made you decide to do that?
For political reasons, again. It would help the ticket more and make room for another guy on the bargaining committee.
Mm-hmm.
Let a man run for the bargaining committee and, you know.
Now, when you went back on the bargaining committee, in between these two stretches of recording secretary, were you still the only woman or were other women now coming in?
I was still the only woman.
Uh-huh. And how about on the executive committee?
On the executive board.
The recording secretary. Were there other women?
Yes, there were other women then. Mm-hmm. We were getting more and more women in after the strike.
Mm-hmm. And what were their positions usually?
We had one financial secretary, and that was a very responsible position. She was a very efficient gal, and she did an excellent job. In fact, she's the best financial secretary we've ever had, and we haven't had one as good since.
Mm.
She really knew her bookkeeping. She really knew how to run an office and everything, you know, and she was very efficient.
And was she part of your caucus?
No, she was part of the Hatchet Gang.
So you were impartial. Someone
yes, I was. Oh, definitely. Oh, definitely. Oh, yes. She married Adam Webb.
Oh, oh.
She was one of the guys out the campaign for me this last time, too. Yeah. Oh, yes. You know, after the election, after an election, if I couldn't go up and congratulate somebody for beating us in any way. I never could do that. People say, well, be a good loser, go up and say congratulations, I'm glad you won. Baloney. If I go out there and knock myself out to win, I'll be damned if I can go up and say, hey, I'm glad you beat me for peace. That's been damn hypocrite, you know. I'll go up and say good luck. And then if the person did a good job, after that election's over, I'll work with them. Because I believe politics, in order to benefit the people, politics should stop there at that time. I'm not saying that your caucus should become dormant, because you never let your caucus ever become dormant. You may only meet once a month for 6 months or a year, but then you've got to keep that machine going and add to it and whatever, you know. But I'd work with them, the opposition, even like right now. The administration's in power up there right now. We have mutual respect.
Mm-hmm.
Although I had a real rotten thing pulled on me a couple of months ago, which you won't believe, and I'll tell you about it for sure. Unbelievable. Rotten.
When we get up to the current period, we're going to believe all that.
But anyway.
Tell me, so it seems like your caucus, basically, once they won that election, that first time around when you were recording secretary, stayed in power?
Yes, we did for a long time. Very long time. We were fortunate enough to have good representatives.
Mm-hmm.
We really did, you know. And, of course, I also learned, too, that in politics, in order to put out a good ticket, a well-balanced ticket, you could pick up votes in areas, you don't always have 100% qualified people, you might say, the sharpest people in the world. But if they're liked in their own area, and that's what their own area wants to put up, then you run the most people for election, you know, see? So, if you keep your people in the shop happy, you're bound to be reelected. And that's, you know, that was the theory that...
Now, were there relationships among the women who were beginning to hold office? Did you develop any kind of support group for each other that crossed caucus lines, or basically were you each in your own caucus?
Oh, no, we're each in our own caucus.
Mm-hmm.
Each in our own caucus. I learned, of course, you know, the hard way, too, that you should try to cultivate those, because when I was on the bargaining committee, and the Hatchet gang was really, man, they wanted to get rid of me, but good, you know, and because being I'm there, and in the hearings, I could report back to membership of things that I didn't particularly like, or let the people know about things that maybe they want to keep covered up, see, and I would be vocal that way, too. I would tell the people, you know, if things that didn't look right to me,
mm-hmm.
And I can remember even to the point up to an arbitration case that I was arbitrating. I had a co-counsel. My co-counsel was an old Hatchet man. He was a very qualified man. He was chairman of the bargaining committee at one time. Real sharp guy, but I was not part of his caucus. And so he was trying to discredit me. And he made some statements, when it came time for me to cross-examine him, because he was involved in the case besides being co-counsel, that he made some statements that actually caused me to lose the case. And I got up at one point, excused myself, and went to the restroom, and I just vomited. It upset me so terribly to think that a person could do that just because I didn't belong to his caucus. It was terrible, you know. So I learned, too, that you should try to cultivate other people. In other words, the most ideal situation, of course, was to try to pick up their best people and bring them to your caucus,
mm-hmm.
The best people. But unfortunately, sometimes the best people were not the most powerful people that had the most votes.
So you became really involved in the caucus.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Very definitely. Very definitely.
And were there other women in your caucus then who started moving into higher and higher positions as well?
Well, the ones that I mentioned, those are pretty high positions.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about conventions between, say, that 51 convention when you went asking for support?
Yeah.
And the point at which you were out of the unit? Do you recall going to other conventions?
You mean when I went out of the bargaining unit?
Yeah.
Well, when I went out of the bargaining unit, I was no longer able to attend any union meetings.
Yeah.
Because
right.
I was...
Up until that point, till say, the mid-60s, right?
Uh-huh.
Early 50s to the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall other international conventions or conferences that you...
Nothing, nothing international convention, that sort of thing. But, of course, there was always the state... conferences and that sort of thing that I kept pitching, you know,
mm-hmm.
at, and also becoming more involved with the assembly and congressional and
now,
Senate places and things like that.
Now, you became involved in, didn't they have a PAC committee?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at what point did you become involved in the political action?
Oh, way back, in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
in the 60s, mm-hmm.
So during that whole period, say, from the time you were first recording secretary, went back to the bargaining committee, then back to recording secretary again,
mm-hmm.
You were involved in a lot of the state
Oh, yes, in the city.
And,
city, state, and national. Right.
And mm-hmm. that's the period also when you probably would have nominated Luther at one of the conventions?
That's right. Okay. In that period of time.
Now, mm-hmm. is there anything else in that period that we should cover more in more detail?
Off the top of my head, I can't think of. Really, you know.
But, you became increasingly involved in elections outside of the union.
Oh, yes.
Political activity outside
yes.
of the union.
Yes.
That would be during the
Kennedy years. That's right. I became very active in the Kennedy years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And up to the point that you went out of the unit then,
right.
in the mid-60s,
mm-hmm.
did you stay as recording secretary or did you then go into another position?
Well, when I left the bargaining unit, you know, I served my term as recording secretary, then I went out of the bargaining unit. When you go out of the bargaining unit, that means you are part of management and you can no longer hold. You have to take an honorable withdrawal from the union. You cannot attend meetings. You have no voice or vote or anything.
Now, tell me how you felt about accepting that position then, given...
Well, it was... I didn't... The idea of becoming part of management was very distasteful to me because I'd had some very bad rough fights with the company. The only reason that I did it, and the job that I took, it was a challenge. There was no women ever in that field, no women at all, you know. The first factory specialist, and the factory specialist job was, it was not an administrative job where I would have to, I would have people under me,
mm-hmm.
where I would have to possibly violate the contract, and, you know, to operate. See, and I told them, I said, that's one thing I would never do. I said, if I take any administrative job, I will operate right down to the contract, and that's it, period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could never violate the contract. So, Betty, you don't have to worry about that if you just help us, because we were just building up for a new ship then, and they needed some help as a specialist. And so I took the job. And at that time, too, I had fallen in love again. And I thought, well, okay, I'm going to take time out now and see what I can do for my union career, you know, and see if I can't make this one work. And so I became a factory specialist, and it was an interesting job.
What was your job exactly?
Well, a factory specialist is one that works with the is an individual who solves the problems and helps make things become more efficient in the management of the shop.
It's almost like a troubleshooter.
Troubleshooter, exactly what it was, like a troubleshooter.
And it wasn't on any single thing, though.
No, I could be, I'd work for a director, and he would send me out to the trouble spots, you know. So, and I would work for this administrator, that administrator, Mr. Administrator, you know. And I couldn't assign people or do anything like that. That wasn't part of my job. My job was going to find out what the problems were and help resolve them.
Mm-hmm.
And make breakdowns on the job, because we had a new airplane coming in then, I remember. And I'd get a blueprint, and then I'd have to make a breakdown, job breakdown. So you could hand it to an assistant foreman or lead man, and then that assistant foreman would give it to his lead man. The lead man would give it to his person in the crew, and they would have an easy way to learn how to build that part of the aircraft. It would tell them step by step by step what to do and how to do it,
mm-hmm.
what drill to use and how to deburr the thing, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, dimple or whatever. See, job breakdowns.
Now, during any of this time, had you gotten additional training?
No.
Was this everything?
No. Everything that I never had any additional training at all. Everything mine was strictly from what I learned in the shop and my own initiative, you know, the training I had on the outside, I went and sought myself. It was just strictly from experience in the shop,
mm-hmm.
the need, you know, whatever the need was, well, to solve something. But I learned to work with engineering. I learned to work with these different people, you know, at Douglas to get the job done. I learned to work production control people, inspection people, all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
My lead experience really prepared me for all that work. In fact, prepared me for all the jobs that I held.
Mm-hmm.
But I was a factory specialist, and then I worked for the director up there. His name was Don Grant. I liked him very much. He was just a really neat Don Grant.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a real fine guy, kind of rough and tough guy. But you know, the fact that I was a woman didn't matter a bit. Man, he'd send me to some real tough areas and whatever. No matter. He had confidence and he appreciated my work.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had an area there where they were just having a heck of a time. So he said, Betty, would you please take an assistant foreman's job out there? I said, oh, Don, no, no, no. I just don't want a crew. I don't want this, don't want that. Well, just take it. We had a contract with United Airlines to build, I think it was 10 Super 61s. That's a beautiful stretch job. And he said, we're having trouble with the cargo area, you know, and door jam area and stuff like that. Would you just take it just to build those 10 airplanes? Well, I liked him so well because he's a real neat guy and a fair guy. He treated the people just great. We never had grievances in the area and stuff like that. I said, okay, Don, for you, I'll do it. So I did. doggone it, after that, then there's another job. Then there's another job.
So you were considered assistant foreman?
Yeah, I was the first female assistant foreman. And it was really something, you know. he said, well, you know, when you go out there, he says, of course, Betty, you know you have to wear a shirt and a tie, you know. And they said, kind of laughed, and I said, oh, hell, that doesn't bother me any, Don. And so I had people, and there was no women in that classification at all, you know. And so a lot of the men said, oh, Betty, you got, by gosh, no, you be sure you wear those little state things in your collar to keep your collar stiff and all that kind of stuff. So I didn't have any shirt ties or anything like that. But anyway, I had a white blouse, and I wore that, and I never will forget. I wore my husband's tie to work the very first day, and here's this big old tie and everything else, you know. And they, a lot of the guys tried to discourage me. A lot of the men did. They really tried to discourage me. And so I wouldn't let that stop me because I had to wear, you know, black pants and white shoes and a white shirt and a tie. So eventually what I did, I bought some nice white blouses, you know, which I send to laundry every week and starch the collars like they used to wear. But I bought these cute little boys pink bow tie and a little ribbon with some sequins on it, and, you know. And I'd wear something at the neck, but it wasn't any man's. Well, after a while, they got so used to seeing me around, they didn't give me a bad time about it, you know. And so I was assistant foreman on many projects then, but I worked for this one director. I liked him real well.
Well, how did you feel about being in management after all those years?
Well, it didn't bother me, I'll tell you. It didn't bother me until, I'll tell you when it got to the point where I had a problem, okay? I had several lead men under me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, they had a big push on. And this was out in Don Grant's area, too. I was out there, you know, and I was assistant foreman, and it really was funny because the foreman was some man that just came in from El Segundo. Then the general foreman used to be a shop steward out in the plant. And he was not a very good one either. He was kind of a dumb guy, but a big bully. He used to be a sergeant in the Army, you know, and he was kind of a bully type guy. Anyhow, he became general foreman out there. So I thought, well, Finnegan's not very smart, but if I don't have to deal with him too directly, I can make it a lot, you know what I mean? As long as he doesn't give my people a bad time. Okay, we had a big push behind schedule thing on this door jam area, and a lot of our parts were purchased parts from the outside from the vendor. Parts, you know, we couldn't fab in the shop. Mm-hmm. Well, we're having a hard time forming it because of titanium and everything else. So, and I had to reject a lot of them because they weren't formed properly, okay? So we got down to the last skin. They said, well, if I reject, that's going to shut the jig down. That'll put weeks and weeks behind schedule. So my assistant, I told my foreman about it, and he said, well, I'll talk with Finnegan about it and see what he wants to do. So he did, you know, let Chinny come in, which is the proper thing to do. Yeah. Well, you tell your lead man, go ahead and use it. So I said, okay. So we used it, but I had to get a tag on it because we couldn't build it according to the engineering specifications because it wasn't a good part, okay? So I got the engineering tag on it. And
meaning that it would have to be reworked,
deviate from the drawing, okay? Got that on there and everything else, and it wasn't too good, didn't look too good. When you reach a certain level, if it's an appearance item, or the exterior of the ship, you know, you have to sell it to the customer. Even though you may sell it to the engineering, makes a disposition, you sell it to the company inspection, they have to sell it to the customer. Well, it got to the point, you know, it was a real tough job. And didn't look good, I didn't like it too well, but they didn't want to lose the time, shut the jig down. It got to the point where we tried to sell it to the customer. The customer says, absolutely not. They wouldn't buy that. That looks terrible. Engineering says, it's safe, it's sound. Unless you want to knock down several $1,000s on this aircraft, we won't buy it. Well, the company wouldn't match it. So they said, when management, top management got into it, Don Grant, what in the world, you know, happened? What in the world happened out there? And I guess he told the top manager, tear that skin off and let's go through the whole thing again. And boy, oh boy, this is awful. So then way above Don Grant, they wanted to know why the jigs were shut down out in Building 12. You know, we're going to lose a month or 6 weeks scheduling on this thing, and that cost them money. So somebody, management out there had to show that they were correcting it, and they're trying to put the blame all the way down to the little people. So the word fills on down to me, the foreman comes in, Betty, you're going to have to recommend your two lead men. I said, what for? Because they used that bad skin. I says, wait a minute. I told them to use that bad skin. And you told me to go ahead and use it. Well, I can't help it. You know, just got to give somebody a recommend. I says, no way. I'm not recommending those people. I said, you recommend those people, you recommend me. And they said, well, no, Betty. I said, well, I mean that. I refuse to reprimand them. And I said, well, we'll recommend you. Let's just go right ahead. I'll be damned. Next day I come to work, and they had a reprimand written up for me to sign. And I heard this was going to happen. See, they were going to buff me out. So I said, well, I said, I refuse to sign, but I want you to know right now that I have a statement going to the vice president of this company advising us actually what happened out here, and how you expecting me to recommend the hourly people on the job here who are not, you know, were not responsible for this thing and are just following orders. You what? I said, that's right. I just put it in the mail about 10 minutes ago. Boy, oh, hell broke loose. I got a call from the director's office. Please come up there right quick. So I went up there, and he said, what in the hell did you do, buddy? I said, well, my God, I said, this isn't right. I told you a long time ago when I first took the job and I first came into management that I would not do anything that would violate the contract. And here I was instructed to recommend two lead men who were as innocent as can be of this whole thing. And we were just being the fall guy for top management, and I don't think that's right. He said, well, why don't you come and tell me about it? I said, I assumed you knew about it. He said, don't you ever use that word again, assumed ever in your whole life. He says, no, I did not know about it. So it got, so I said, he said, my God, do you realize what you're doing, sending a letter to the Vice President Cleveland? I said, yes, I do. I said, but I feel strongly about that, and I feel like I've been betrayed, you know. And I said, it's not fair. And he said, my God, but I said, well, if I can get a hold of that letter, my girlfriend is the lead in the mailroom, and she happened to be there, and I didn't have it. I had written it up at night at home, but I didn't put it in the mail. I figured they're going to pull a bluff on me. Hey, baby, goes back. But I'm not the reprimand those lead now, because that goes in their records, and that's terrible to have. A reprimand for poor workmanship is terrible in your record, you know. So they pulled it, and there was no reprimands issued. Not at all.
And then what happened then to you after
that? All right, after that, then, after that.
What year was that, Betty?
60s, late 60s, I can't remember. But anyway, so then, after that, then the next job came along, Cleveland, the man that I wrote to. We were having trouble areas, and I finished up those 10 aircraft, okay, United Airlines. Finished them up, great, and we regained our schedule and everything else, even with a damn rotten part. I mean, having to wait for new parts, we regained our schedule, our part of the aircraft. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we're having trouble in another area, and here I was assistant foreman, okay? So what they did, then they asked me if I wouldn't go with the task force group to help out another area. The DC, what ship was that? 9, I think it was, you know, DC-9. Not the super, the 9. The 9's just coming in. So I said, okay, so here, Don Grant was the head of it, and Hank Cash, who was the general foreman in another area, who was a good friend, and Llewellyn, who was a general foreman, and then a foreman of 316 time standards. So, we, you know, and I was the only woman on that task force thing, and I was the manufacturing rep, too, see, so... We'd go out there, and we'd send us to certain areas, we'd go in there, and we'd try to find out, just like a factory special zone, there'd be a whole team of us. Mm-hmm. And we would have, like, blank check. We'd see something wrong, we'd call up and order it, and come in and fix it right away. If they need tooling, we'd call and order it, and boy, they'd come right now, so, you know, all that sort of thing. It was really a great, great job. And I can tell you what year that was, because I got a commendation from the, excuse me, management in Palmdale. Anyway, this was the last assignment I was on. Task force.
Now, was this in, you had to go
so what happened? Yeah, so what happened, honey, was this, see, so.
Well, this is this July 1967.
That's right, uh-huh. Anyway, so we went to different sections of the plant, military and commercial, you know, and we were team-like. Then we had a real bottleneck up there in Palmdale. And I eventually ended up being administrative of the control center there in Long Beach, too, where we'd have one huge, they call it war rooms, and it had to do with the fabrication of parts and the welding of parts and everything else. The flow to the line was really lost up and bottlenecked and everything else. So I was administrator over the, they call it the war room, and it had to do, like I say, with the expediting parts and that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
and resolving engineering problems and that sort of thing. Very successful,
mm-hmm.
because we had several models of aircraft, and that's the whole plant, you know. Several model aircraft going, commercial and military. So we were just getting our contracts, too. We were working on contracts for the Marine Corps, the A4M, that real hot ship that's been so popular for many years, you know. And also the automatic ejection seat, too, that we sell to a lot of other airline companies. Anyway, so they had this real bad problem up in Palmdale, so they asked me if I wouldn't go to Palmdale and with this task force. And so, of course, at that time, you know, my husband, I said, at that time we couldn't get married because he was married. He was separated from his husband. We couldn't get married. And we didn't, in fact, we were together about, 8 or 9 years, and finally his wife gave him a divorce, and then we were married legally 1 year, and then he died in 1968. Anyway, I talked to my husband about, as far as everybody's concerned, I was married, you know, because we were together always. And so my husband said, my husband, Alice Ammon, was the service manager for Melbourne Sport down here. He was management then, you know, and he'd been general manager of Kelly's in Los Angeles, and that big Kelly's organization that established the Blue Book for cars. He was general manager up there. He had a heart attack, and so he had to take a lesser job with less pressure on him, and he became, you know, come down here to Long Beach and took the service manager's job down here. Anyway, Ellis and I got along so great. He was never jealous of anything I did. He encouraged me. He would come to union meetings. He would just a little short-sleeved shirt, you know, not in his business clothes, and he would come. He was 6'4 and a quarter, great big guy, you know. And if here's somebody out in the audience giving me a bad time, you know, everything else, he would go out and sit beside him, and he was something else. I told him, I says, my God, if Melbourne's ever finds out that you're going to union, means you lose your job. Oh, I don't care, Mama, you know. Anyway, so Ellis said he was all for it. He says, honey, that's great, you know, you go for it. And so I went up there, and when I first went up there to Palmdale, boy, they gave me a blank check there, too. Betty set up a control center here. Whatever you need, you just tell me what you need, we'll get it. I had, and so at first, I'd fly up every day back and forth. And, gee, that was kind of tough because I didn't have enough hours up there, only maybe 4 or 5 hours a day, because I had, they'd fly me up in the little plane that didn't have any radar or anything, and, my God, you had to wait until the fog lifts, and that meant not leaving until 10 o'clock in the morning. That was bad news. Right. From Long Beach, up in Douglas Plant.
The Douglas Plant.
Up to the Palmdale Plant, you know. And so it wasn't very good. And so then I decided, and they really needed help badly up there, and I wasn't getting enough done to my satisfaction. So then decided that better stay up there for a while. So they asked me to stay up there because everybody else was up there. The task force people, they were up there in motels and hotels up there. I was the only one back and forth, you know. So my husband, he was so great. He said, well, I'll take my vacation. And we had two dogs, two little doxies. He said, the babies now come out there, and we'll stay out there and have vacation. We'll stay with you, Mama, so you'll be able to stay up there. You know, and he knew how important the job was to me. So he did. He took 2 weeks vacation, and so I stayed up there then. And after 2 weeks vacation, then I drove back and forth. And they furnished me a brand-new Buick, you know. And, boy, I tell you, I'd take that takeoff in the morning. I'd get up there, and as soon as I get there, one of the men would come over and pick up the car, and they'd wash it every day, fill up the gas every day. And they treated me like a queen up there. They were just great because they really appreciated the help. And
what was your official title
then? All right, now at that time, I was still an assistant foreman. That's what I was classified as, and I was charged to development experimental. Okay, but I was really task force. But it was task force. It was task force work. I was task force assignment, troubleshooting assignment. Really task force assignment. But classification wise, I was assistant foreman. But I was charged in the development budget. And so, but I didn't have any people. I had to hire a lot of Kelly girls to start with up there to set up this big control center. And then eventually we got our own union people in there. But I had to set and organize the thing and get the machines in there and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I did that. And most people were under me. And I was assistant foreman, so I could do that. I could assign them. All right, then took care of that, and that was very successful. Then when I came back, they wanted me to set up another control center, just the DC-10. So I set up a control center, and then they wanted me to take over an area of DC-10. They wanted me to go into development. This is when we had called the Aaron Bird development. So I took over the as assistant foreman out in the shop again, which I didn't really want to do because, you know, if it meant that I'd have to recommend people and stuff like that, I didn't want to have anything to do with that kind of stuff. But I did it again as a favor to my old friend. And I took over the cables and all the oxygen lines and the development of a lot of the new systems in DC-10, casting systems and that sort of thing, and the a lot of the